nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Today we consider the optical properties of three basic classes of materials, metals, semiconductors, and insulators, and discuss what is different, what is in common between these materials. Because that's, of course, very important for understanding how light interacts with materials. So we need to learn a little bit more about materials to understand the interaction of light with them. Well, a couple announcements, good news and bad news. Really bad news, we don't have classes next week, so I see how much you're disappointed. But we do have class this Thursday. And really good news that homework is coming. It's due September the 12th, so not that much enthusiasm. anyway, so let me just briefly remind you what we discussed last time. We emphasized that there is this beautiful Lorentz model which treats atoms of which any material is built as harmonic oscillators. And the idea here that we of course know that energy, electron energies in atoms are quantized so that there are discrete energy levels, and each particular atomic transition could set in correspondence to a harmonic oscillator. Let's say the frequency of this particular transition is omega naught, where omega naught is, let's say this is E2 and this is E1. Omega 2 would be E2 minus E1 over H bar. And we would put in correspondence to this with this atomic transition a harmonic oscillator at the same frequency omega naught. If you look then now at another atomic transition, let's say this one, that would be another harmonic oscillator with frequency omega 1, and so on. So any particular atom could be thought of as just a set of harmonic oscillators. That's a really important thing. And if my light has a frequency close to any particular atomic transition, let's say to this one, then the interaction with this atomic transition is by far stronger than the interaction with any other transition because of the resonance. And therefore, you could think of the whole atom as just one harmonic oscillator with the frequency omega naught. That's the essence of the Lorentz model, and it works really nicely. I mean, to be specific, if the intensity of light is not too high, then atom can be considered as just a single harmonic oscillator with the frequency which is close to the frequency of your light. So because that particular transition would interact with light in the most efficient way. That's the idea. So therefore, we could think of, let's say, atom as just harmonic oscillator with frequency omega naught. And why it's harmonic oscillator we already discussed, because you could think of this orbiting of electron around the positively charged nucleus as just a harmonic motion, in the same way as we treat, let's say, spinning of moon around the Earth. Or you could think it in a different way, that the interaction between electron and positively charged nucleus also goes like 1 over r squared, the same way as the gravitational force. Therefore, these two systems should be equivalent in terms of their description. Of course, it's a classical model, but as I said, that actually when you do rigorous quantum mechanical consideration, you pretty much reproduce this result. So you can feel quite comfortable by describing atoms as just a set of harmonic oscillators. And today, as I mentioned, we consider these three basic classes of different materials, such as insulators. We mentioned things like lattice absorption, color centers. And by the way, what are insulators? Insulators, like for example, glass would be an insulator. They typically, in most cases, they're transparent. Not always, but in many cases. Why they typically transparent? Because the transition between ground state, electronic state, and the first band is actually typically much larger than the energy of photon in the visible. Therefore, they are quite often transparent, such as glass. Semiconductors, extremely important class of materials. All electronics is based on semiconductors. So we discuss things like energy bands, or so-called Urbach tail, excitons, which are very important for understanding properties of semiconductors. And finally, metals. Metals have something like renaissance now. Metals, belief is, would play an increasingly important role. And for nanophotonics, this is the material of choice. Same role as semiconductors play in nanoelectronics, metals are expected to play in nanophotonics. And I will explain, actually, not only today, but through all the course, why metals are so special for nanophotonics. In other words, without metals, you probably cannot do nanophotonics. They are extremely important, as important as semiconductors in nanoelectronics. So, and when we speak of metals, we would emphasize what makes them different from other classes of materials. And of course, you know that the first thing remember here that electrons are free to move. So there are free conduction electrons in metals. That's what makes them different from other materials. And later through the course, we will see why it's so important in the context of nanophotonics. And we also, of course, consider optical properties of molecules, nanoparticles, and microparticles. When we say nano, we mean it's in nanoscale, and micro, it's on micron scale. That also reminds you what we consider the refractive index. And when we use this Lorentz model, which is the model of harmonic oscillator, so we showed that the refractive index has this form, is the imaginary part looking like this, picked at the resonant frequency omega naught, and with the real part having this so-called dispersive behavior, so which shown in this picture. All right, so that's the outline of the previous lecture and what we're going to consider today. Let's move on. Let's start from the very basic. Let's start from a single atom. And the simplest atom, and to tell you the truth, the only atom which is fully described quantum mechanically is the hydrogen atom, when we have only one proton and one electron orbiting around the proton. So, and we know that to describe this atom, we use Schrödinger equation, and then by solving that equation, you find this energy, quantize electron energies, and let's say if you have a particular atomic transition, with the frequency close to the frequency of light, and then only that transition matters because of the resonance. So then you would have one particular energy level, this one, okay, where electron can be excited. Because without excitation, electron always sits in its ground state. What would happen if you would bring two atoms together? And obviously then the interaction occurs, and this energy level, any particular energy level, would split into two. And with the way people show this, they typically plot this energy versus distance, and they would say that there is an anti-bonding effect and bonding effect. Why it's called this one called is bonding? Because you see, in this case, the discrete level can be formed, the bound state can be formed. Whereas here, you cannot have a bound state. Electrons wouldn't be really bound to two atoms in this case. And the position of energy depends on the distance between atoms. So when you bring atoms closer, so then the distance becomes smaller, you move along this energy curve toward the origin. And the same is true about antibonding. So, and this is equivalent with distance at which actually you form a stable molecule.
I have a question on that one.
Yes, please.
Is that the energy, like, potential of the atoms or the energy of the two electrons on the two curves? I'm just not sure what's...
Well, in this case, I'm speaking of potential energy of atoms, okay, forming a molecule.
Okay. So, like,
So in this case, let's say to have a stable molecule, you have to sit somewhere here. If you sit here, then your molecule cannot exist. I mean, it would basically fall apart. Yes, this is represent the potential energy of two atoms forming molecule. And now I'm speaking actually of electrons. Thank you for asking this question. It clarifies. So if I consider a particular atomic orbital, so I have this particular energy level. And when I bring two atoms together, then you have this splitting. You have two. So when they're far away from each other, they're identical. Therefore, they have the same energy. But when you bring them together, because of the interaction, you have two levels, one with high energy, another with low energy. So when you have four atoms, you have four levels and so on. When you have lots of atoms, like 10 to the 23, as we typically have in solids, so then you have a band, what we call band, consisting of many, many overlapping layers, energy levels. So therefore, you treat it as just a continuous band of energy levels. And when we speak of the visible, when we speak of the electron state, that all the typical energy we are talking about is 1 eV. Okay, like 2 eV is the visible. 1 eV is actually near infrared, but the scale is, and when you go to 4 eV, it's already ultraviolet. So that's the scale of energy which we are interested in. And another thing to keep in mind is the Pauli principle. For any particular energy level within the band, you can place only two electrons in. And the reason why you can place two electrons because they can have a different spin, one looking up, another looking down. So that's very important. It's lots of properties of materials can and should be understood only taking into account the Pauli principle. So if you now try to plot these energy bands as a function of distance of atoms, so when you make, you take lots of these atoms and bring them closer and closer to each other, you have this formation of the bands. Those electrons which are sitting first in inner shells of atomic orbits, they could still be more or less localized or form very narrow bands. And those which are sitting on outermost orbits, they form this overlapping bands, like it's shown here. So let's say originally it was this orbit and this orbit. When you bring them together, they start form different bands, and these bands, which originate from these two different orbits in atoms, could overlap, as it's shown here. So, and when you... So the thing here is to emphasize that electrons in inner shells almost do not interact. When you have a solid, they kind of don't feel interaction with other atoms because they sit in close to their nuclei and they don't feel that external surrounding. Whereas these outermost electrons strongly interact, for different atoms, for neighbor atoms, and form bands which can overlap as it's shown here. Well, that's very important basis for classification of matters. What typically happens is depicted in these two pictures. If you have a certain band which is filled with electrons, but not all energy states are filled, there are still empty states. Like here it's shown, let's say, half of the band filled with electrons, whereas the other half is not filled. So that's what we call conduction band, and this is typical for metals. Because you see that now you start feeling any particular energy state. You place two electrons with two different spins looking up and down. So the lowest energy state is occupied, and you go to the upper state, and so on and so on. And then you place all electrons which you're supposed to place. And you fill it out up to this level, which is called the Fermi level. But there are lots of energy states available, so that electron can easily change, for example, its momentum. Therefore, if you apply electron, it can start move. It would get accelerated and change its momentum. So, but to have this ability freely move and feel the electrical field when you apply it, so you have to have these available states. So that's, in other words, you have to have this situation when you have a conduction band with lots of states available, not occupied by electrons. Another situation which is typical for, this describes metal. Another situation is typical for insulator or semiconductor when you have a low band which is fully filled by electrons. In other words, all the possible states are occupied. And then there is a gap, no energy states available. And the lowest available energy state have energy above the energy of this Fermi level by the value Eg, where Eg represents the energy of the gap. Okay, so that's situation which is typical for insulator or semiconductor. So here in the band, all the states filled up, no available states, and the next available states would be separated in terms of energy by gap. So this the case of insulator and semiconductors. That's a very important difference between the metals and insulator and semiconductors. Another thing which I would like you to have in mind is that we mentioned it already. There are three different basic motion related to molecules. One is electronic motion, and the typical energy is. That's electronic transition. Typical energies are involved are 1, 2 eV, 3 eVs. Few EVs, okay? Or in terms of the wavelengths, it would be submicron, let's say 400, 500 nanometers, half a micron or so, a fraction of a micron. That's where transition associated with electron motions occur. So then the absorption coefficient would have something like this, would have the form something like this. So it absorbs in the submicron wavelength range, or in terms of EV, it's in the EV range. So that covers the visible and ultraviolet part of the spectrum. And then the other type of motion, which provides absorption in the infrared part of the spectrum, to be specific, in the mid-infrared part of the spectrum, is associated with vibration of atoms in molecule. And as I pointed out last time, typical energy of vibrations related to the energy or frequency of electrons through these relations is mass of electron divided by the mass of a proton. And this is roughly a factor of, let's say, 1 over 30. Because this ratio is roughly 1,000. The proton is heavier than electron by 1800. So when you take a square root of this, it's something like this. So therefore, it brings you, in terms of the wavelengths, to the range of, let's say, 10 to 100 micron. That's where the absorption of electromagnetic wave occurs through the excitation of vibrational states, vibration of atoms in molecule. And then yet another, the same factor would bring you to rotational states associated with rotation of atoms in molecule, which would be, in terms of energy, smaller than this, smaller than the energy of vibration by the same factor, roughly. Well, it's clear, these electronic states are associated with motion of electrons. They move much faster, frequency is larger, and whereas vibration are associated with motion of atoms, so which are heavier, and therefore the frequency would be less. Okay, so therefore you have strong absorption in the visible and UV, it's all associated with motion of electrons, and strong absorption in the mid-infrared, that's related to the motion of atoms in molecules, specifically with vibration. Well, that's we already saw this plot. It shows the refractive index, which characterizes the propagation of light in materials as a function of the wavelengths. So silicon stands out, and silicon is a very important material for nanoelectronics, actually for nanophotonics as well, because of its large refractive index. It turns out because of the larger refractive index, you can accomplish stronger confinement of light when you use silicon. We will discuss it later. And the thing here is that it's pretty much flat in a very broad spectral range. So, and there are also a number of other materials which show spectral dependence of the refractive index. For all of them, there is always some range where you can ignore the dependence of the refractive index on the frequency. But in principle, the refractive index, of course, does depend on frequency, and that's acquired by the Cramer-Skronig relations, because all materials actually absorb and have dispersion. And this absorption property and dispersion property related to each other through the Cramer-Skronig relation, because as we discussed already, the dispersion is related to the refractive index, which is the real part of complex refractive index, and, or let's say it's related in turn to the real part of susceptibility, whereas absorption is related to the imaginary part of susceptibility. And the real and imaginary part are in turn related through the Cramer-Skronig relation. So you have a homework assignment, which is due September the 12th, which considers the so-called color centers. I just say a few words about this. It's related to insulators, and typically insulators have a very large gap, as I already mentioned, and therefore there is no absorption. They are transparent. Okay, that's what's typical for insulators. However, it turns out that you can introduce defects in insulators by, for example, irradiating them with ion beam or X-ray, and then these insulators have beautiful colors. And every time you have colors, it means that there is absorption of certain part of the spectrum, of the visible spectrum, that eventually results in colors. Like one part of a color, one part of the white light gets reflected more, others gets absorbed more. That creates all these beautiful colors. And if you have something colorful like what is shown here, it means that there is strong interaction with particular part of the spectrum. So what happens with this type of insulators, you create defect states, which also can be treated as by using this Lorentz model. And these defect states absorb particular frequency, particular spectral range from the visible light, from the white light. So therefore, these colors appear. So your homework assignment is related to these color centers. I mean, but that's used just as an example. Basically, you still use the Lorentz model and you can answer all the questions related to this homework assignment. Okay, now let's consider a little bit these basic absorption processes in semiconductors. And let's start from the part of the spectrum related to the mid-infrared part, which is in terms of EV would be somewhere between 100s, between let's say 10 milliEV and 100 milliEV, MeV. So that is that's where the absorption associated with lattice. Okay, atoms in semiconductors vibrate, so and therefore absorption associated with motion of atoms in lattice with phonons. Okay, and there are so-called acoustic phonons, there are optical phonons, but in either case, that's we are speaking of this mid-infrared part of the spectrum. Please pay attention to what is plotted on the vertical axis is logarithm of the absorption. Okay, so these strong peaks associated with different vibrations of atoms in lattice. Okay, when you go to the higher energies, the absorption still can occur through multi-phonon absorption, but the probability to absorb several phonons simultaneously, and a phonon is just a quantum vibration. So same way as photon describes a quantum energy for light, phonon describes a single quantum of energy for vibrations. So when you go to the higher energies, to provide absorption of electromagnetic radiation of this high energy, it has to be multiphonon absorption. Therefore, probability of this process is much lower, and that several orders of magnitude lower. That's what is clearly seen here. When you go to the visible and part of the spectrum, then the absorption occurs because of the electronic excitation. In the case of semiconductors, we call it exciton lines because excited electron strongly interacts with its hole. And this interacting couple of electrons in the hole We call exciton, and we will discuss it just in a moment. So we have these sharp lines, resonant lines of absorption, which associated with excitons. When you go to the near-infrared part of the spectrum, you still have this absorption, and that's called Urbach tail. And in this case, absorption occurs because in a single event, both photon and phonon are absorbed, like it's shown here. Again, since it's nonlinear process, the probability of this process is much lower. Therefore, again, the absorption is much lower, but it's still non-zero. So the absorption at energy is lower than the photon, than the energy of a single photon. Larger than the energy of a single photon occurs with participation of both photon and phonon. And since it's a since it's a nonlinear process, it has a lower probability. That's what we call Urbach tail. All right, that's a typical process. So phonon absorption, multiphonon regime, Urbach tail, which involves phonon and photon, and exciton lines, direct absorption of a single photon. Yes?
So does that minimum area correspond to the flat line we saw for silicon in refractive index, where the absorption is minimum? Doesn't that correspond to each other?
Well, that's not exactly true. Well, it does overlap, but it's not necessarily exactly the minimum, because the range where silicon is flat is broader than this. But it's roughly coincide with this range. But silica relatively flat is actually goes a little bit farther in both directions. That's this minimum. It is roughly in this range, but broader than the minimum. But anyway, it's shown just qualitatively. It depends for different material, it's different. Okay, let's understand a little bit these excitons, which are really important for understanding properties of semiconductors. And to do that, let's consider the hydrogen atom, because excitons have lots of in common with conventional hydrogen atom. So that the first description of proper description of hydrogen atom was given actually by Niels Bohr using his semi-classical model, where he pointed out, we analyzed a set of available experimental data, and he pointed out that energy are quantized, discrete, and he described this electron energy in atoms by using this famous formula. And of course, this formula is reproduced by quantum mechanics developed later. So let's look at this. First of all, the energy is proportional to the charge of electron raised to the power of 4 into the mass of electron. And in the denominator, you have this Planck's constant squared. And the very important, this quantum number, energy quantum number, n squared. So you can see that the lowest energy when n equal 1 would be equal 13.6 eV, which is deep UV. And then when you increase n, the energy goes, the next level would have minus 3.4 eV energy, and then yet the next one would be minus 1.51, and so on. That's described energy levels in the hydrogen atom. Well, and HD is the Planck's constant. So let's now look at the excitons in the semiconductor. What happens in this case, electron is excited, but actually does feel interaction with a hole left behind. And this hole and electron could be treated as a hydrogen atom, because you again have interaction of negatively charged electron with positively charged hole. And so you could think in the same terms of this pair of electron in a hole as electron and a proton in the hydrogen atom. So you still have this orbiting of electron around the hole, classically speaking. So the difference, very important difference, that the distance between electron and hole is much larger. And the size, therefore, of this exciton is much larger than the size of a hydrogen atom. So, and to be specific, let's say this exciton Bohr, which characterizes the size of your system, is roughly 5 nanometers, as opposed to the hydrogen atom, which is roughly just a few angstrom or one angstrom. So there is a huge difference in terms of the size. And another very important factor here is that all this occurs, if you're speaking of silicon, in a host, which is basically the material of silicon, and the epsilon for silicon is very large. Okay, that's really important. It's, epsilon is large on the scale of 12, so that therefore this epsilon, which stands in the denominator, it should be added to the denominator because it characterizes how much field is less. So therefore, you could think still of this exciton as just a hydrogen atom. But the thing is, you have to replace the mass of electron, which is, was in the numerator, by this reduced effective mass. And the reduced effective mass is given through this formula. Okay. So when the mass of one of the two particles is much larger, then you can ignore this term. If the mass of the whole is much larger, then the effective reduced mass is roughly equal to the mass of electron, which is the case, for example, for the hydrogen atom, where proton is much heavier than electron. In excitons, it's not always the case, and the reduced mass could be different from the mass of a free electron. So what we do, we put the effective mass of electron to cancel out the mass which was in the numerator and replace it with the reduced mass. And the very important factor we added here is the dielectric constant epsilon squared. So, and as a result, typical value for the energy bands goes from EV, several EVs, to the range of between 10 and 100 milliEV. That's a huge difference. So you could still think of exciton as kind of a system similar to the hydrogen atom, but with much lower energy levels. Yes?
Is this complicated by the fact that silicon is anisotropic?
No, it's not. It's not the case. So the thing here is that silicon has extremely large epsilon. That's really, really important here. And because its epsilon is so large, the energy is so much lower. Yes.
You're using in this formula not the real epsilon, but
the relative. Yes, that's important. Thank you for asking. This is the relative epsilon. Okay. So when I mentioned this 12, it's relative epsilon. It's not the real one. All right, metals. So, and I, of course, we will speak of semiconductors more, but semiconductors, let's say, it's not as important for nanophotonics as metals. Metals are extremely important because metals play a very important trick with light. So I mentioned in the beginning, in the introduction to this course, that one of the most fundamental problems of nanophotonics is how to couple light, which has a submicron wavelength, let's say half a micron, to a nanostructure, which could be 100 times less. If you have a nanostructure 5 nanometers small, so and the wavelength is, let's say, 500 nanometers, so there is two orders of magnitude mismatch in size. Therefore, the interaction would be extremely small. What the trick which metals play, when you irradiate metal with light, under certain condition, you can excite electronic waves called surface plasmon polaritons. They are like light, but they're actually coupled states of light and electrons. And these surface plasmon polaritons have the same frequency as the frequency of light, which excited these excitations of electrons mixed with photons. But the difference is that the wavelengths of these surface plasmon polaritons could be extremely small, 10 nanometers. So you see, you have quite unusual waves, which have optical frequencies, but X-ray wavelengths. And if you have a wavelength, you start originally with a wave which has, let's say, optical frequency 10 to the 15, but very large wavelengths. And if it, that light would couple to, if you try to couple that light to a nanostructure, the coupling efficiency would be extremely low. But if you use metal, then in metal you can excite these surface plasmon polaritons, which still have the optical frequency, but the wavelengths for these waves shrinked by by up to orders, two orders of magnitude, and it becomes as small as, let's say, 10 nanometers. And then this wave, new wave, which has same optical frequency but much shorter wavelengths, can very efficiently couple to nanostructures. So, and therefore, metals which support these surface plasmon excitations could be used as a means to couple strongly light to nanostructures. So in a sense, metals are capable, through surface plasmons, focus light down to nanoscale, to the wavelengths, to the size which is much smaller than the wavelengths of light in air, but related to the wavelengths of surface plasmon excitations, which could be on the scale of 10 nanometers. So you focus light through surface plasmons down to nanoscale and then effectively couple it to nanostructures. That's what, of course, we will discuss it by far more detail, but that gives you the idea why metals are so important for nanophotonics, because metals focus light down to nanoscale and by doing that provide efficient interaction of light to nanostructures. It's not the whole story, but that's the basic idea. So metals, through surface plasmon that they support, allow to concentrate, to confine, to focus light down to very small nanoscale areas, and that enables these nanophotonics. Therefore, for nanophotonics, metals is the material of choice. For electronics, it's silicon. If you want to integrate nanoelectronics and nanophotonics, which is the goal, that's realistic theory. That's what really we would like to have, to have optoelectronic device, which, because electronics is, it's a great, powerful tool. Nanophotonics is better in some other senses, but to combine the two, you could take advantages of these both different approaches to create devices to process information. So then silicon as the material of choice for nanoelectronics, metals, particularly noble metals such as silver and gold, materials of choice for nanophotonics, and by combining the two, we could create a family of new devices. And the beauty of things that silicon, there's all the silicon nanoelectronics, they still have metallic structures. These chips becoming smaller and smaller in the size of the metallic structure. Of course, in that case, it's copper. They still use these conductors. Becomes very small, where all these effects we're going to study here becomes important. But so far, these nanophotonic effects were not explored, were not really employed in these nanoelectronic circuits. But we are getting really close to this. Like, well, we are now working in close collaboration with IBM people, like Dr. Vlasov, for example. And we're trying to get advantage of this fact that these metallic structures, which we already have on this nanocircuits, silicon nanocircuits, actually could support the surface plasmon excitations, which could be employed for various nanophotonics effects. So I would envision within 5 years or so, we would have these integrated circuits, which would do both nanophotonic processing information and nanoelectronic processing of information. And by combining the advantages of both approaches, more powerful devices can be eventually developed. So, but that just emphasizes the importance of these different classes of materials. And we actually spent quite a big part of this course discussing these very unique properties of metals and why they are so important for nanophotonics. All right, so let's consider very basic properties by using this simple model. As we know, electrons are free to move in metals. You could ask why there is no strong, why there is no this problem of interaction of electrons with the hole as we have in the semiconductors. The dielectric permittivity in metal is actually huge, negative and huge. It could be like 100 to 1,000. And therefore, the interaction of electron with the hole, you could say, screened by this huge epsilon. Therefore, electrons are nearly free. Not exactly free, but nearly free. So, and therefore, the interaction of these electrons and holes, which is so important for semiconductors, doesn't play much role in metals. Electrons could be treated as nearly free particles. And as such, we can describe them by using these simple equations. It's basically Newton's second law, mass times acceleration is equal to the force. And the force here is just the electrical field multiplied by the charge of electron. And the difference with the Lorentz model, which we considered before, there is no any restoring force. Okay, when we considered bound electron in atom, there was a restoring force related to interaction with positively charged nucleus, and which made electron orbiting around its equilibrium position. Now we assume that electron can freely move, there is no any restoring force, therefore the Newton's second law acquired a simple form. Mass times acceleration is equal to the applied force, driving force, which is just the charge times the electrical field. The only thing we want to take into account is some damping, which always occurs, which would be related to the resistance. Electrons, of course, collide with some defects, phonons. They're not free to move, and they're not exactly free to move. There are some collisions, some resistance. And that we describe by this damping force as mass times velocity and divided by some characteristic time of relaxation. Of course, this time would be related to some kind of mean free path, and typical relaxation time in the scale of 10 to the minus 14, or could be slightly longer, 10 to the minus 13. Whereas the typical time orbiting related to the visible is 10 to the minus 15. So the relaxation rate is 1 to 2 orders of magnitude less than the typical frequency characterizing the optical range. Okay, so if you look now at this equation, this is our equation. This we can replace the second derivative of displacement time as just we can write down as the first derivative of velocity. So that's my equation. Say it again. Oh yes, okay. There must be mess here. Thank you. Sorry. So there must be mass here, okay. And so we look at the solution in this form, okay, because we assume that electrical field is light, which oscillates with frequency omega. Since the driving force has this harmonic dependence, the response should also have this dependence. So that's the solution, the form of solution we are looking at. So and then substituting this into this equation, we immediately find out the V as a function of omega, where omega is the frequency of light. We can easily solve it. And then the current density, by definition, the current density is the electron density times the charge times the velocity. Okay? That's what the current density is. The number of electrons per unit time, per unit area. So it's the number density times the charge of electron times the velocity. So if you found the velocity, you found the current. It's a very important formula, actually, from very simple consideration, which is just Newton's law applied for freely moving particle, charged particle electron. And you found this very important formula for the density current. And, of course, the coefficient of proportionality between the density current and the applied field is called conductivity. This is a very fundamental formula. So that's the formula we obtained just a second before. So you see here there is some relaxation related to resistance. So, and the coefficient of proportionality that I just mentioned is called conductivity, which is a function of frequency, which can be written this way, where by sigma naught, we mean the conductivity, the DC conductivity. If the frequency is equal to zero, this term goes away, and the conductivity becomes equal to the DC conductivity. Conductivity in the case when the applied field is does not vary in time. So, and as you can see, the DC conductivity is given by n density number times c squared divided by the mass and divided by the relaxation rate. It's a very fundamental characteristic called the DC conductivity. And the frequency dependence is sitting right here. All right, so let's now understand better different contribution to the response of a material. And for that, let's recall this curl equation for the magnetic field. And you can see that for the in this equation, there are two source terms in the right-hand side of the equation. One is the time derivative of the density of the electrical flux D, or the displacement current, plus the current. The reason we call it the displacement current, because you see it contributes in the same way as the conventional current. Therefore, sometimes it's called the displacement current. So if you now recall that this D, the electrical flux, is defined as epsilon times the electrical field, so then we can write this equation in this way. I put here purposely the subscript B. What I mean by this, that it's we are speaking here of the bound electrons, electrons which do not move in the material, but remain in the vicinity of their nuclei. Okay, those we call bound electrons. There are two different responses of material, which are, kind of course, interrelated and can be combined into one unified response. One is associated with bound electrons, electrons which are sitting at the equilibrium position related to their atomic centers. So, and that response we typically describe by the displacement current, by this D. So D is equal epsilon B times E, that's one term, and another term is related to freely moving electrons, such as in metals, the density current. Okay, so if you do that, and if you now again assume that the electrical field has this monochromatic dependence, and substitute into this equation, then we get these two terms. You see, and they actually enter in the same way. Here we have minus I omega epsilon, the electric permittivity associated with bound electrons, and here we have sigma. And these two terms can be combined into one, as it's written here, and called effective dielectric permittivity. So the thing to appreciate here, it could be confusing, and please listen to me carefully, that some people in some textbook prefer to speak of only conductivity. There is no any epsilon, just conductivity, only some complex, because equally I could do it not this way, but I could combine these two terms and introduce sigma effective. And I would speak of only current and some effective sigma, where sigma would consist not only this term, but also this term. Right? And then in the right-hand side of the equation, I would have only the current, but with some complex conductivity, effective conductivity, which includes not only free electrons, but also bound electrons. This is one way of describing. Another way, as it's shown here, I introduce the effective dielectric permittivity, which includes not only bound electrons, but also free electrons. And now I don't have any conductivity. I have only effective permittivity. So either of these three ways, of course, are equal in terms of describing. You could have epsilon associated with bound electrons and conductivity associated with free electrons and keep these both terms. Or what people prefer to do, they speak either one effective conductivity, where it includes the contribution to the current coming from both bound electrons and free electrons, or alternatively, effective dielectric permittivity. That's, for example, what people from optics prefer to use, because in optics, the most important term actually is this term, this associated with permittivity, with bound electrons, with polarization, basically. Therefore, the more appropriate language in optics is actually this effective dielectric permittivity. But when you're speaking of metals, of course, this term is very important, which does need to be taken into account. Okay, but still we speak in terms of this effective dielectric permittivity. When you move toward the microwave range, this term plays most important role, the conduction current. So then the preferable language is to speak of the effective conductivity, where the some contribution to conductivity comes from the bound electrons. So it basically depends on the community, on the spectral range. In the microwave range, people prefer to speak of the effective conductivity because the common thing is this conduction current, J, which dominates. Please pay attention, the displacement current is proportional to the frequency. The larger the frequency, the more important this term. When you move to the optical range, this term plays a crucial role. When you go to the microwave range, this term is much smaller than this one. It just provides small correction to the conductivity. So therefore, you speak of this effective conductivity. In the optical range, you do the other way around. You speak of the effective permittivity. Don't get confused about this. Physically, it's just contribution from bound electrons and free electrons, but people prefer to combine the two contributions and speak of only effective dielectric permittivity. That is the case typically for the optical range. That's a more appropriate language. Or only effective conductivity, which is typically the language used in the microwave range. And when you go to the DC case, then these terms goes away. So, and the another important thing, the displacement current becomes progressively important when you go to the higher frequency range. And for the optical range, it is a critical term. And if you speak of metals, then these two terms are equally important. Since we are considering optics, nanophotonics, we will speak of this effective dielectric permittivity. That will be our language. And it's related to the dielectric. All this term could be called effective conductivity. So you can see that effective dielectric permittivity related to effective conductivity through this prefactor. That's a simple formula. Okay? So the effective dielectric permittivity related to the effective conductivity through this simple relation. So, and as I said, when you're depending on the frequency range, you prefer to use the language of sigma or the language of epsilon effective. Any questions related to this? Because it could be confusing, and since, particularly for people who kind of working with different spectral ranges, it's really important to keep in mind these type of things. So that's basically, again, we just rewrite this effective permittivity, the contribution coming from bound electrons, and the contribution coming from the conduction electrons, where sigma is given by this expression. All right, so as I mentioned, the relaxation rate by roughly 1 to 2 orders of magnitude less than the frequency for the optical range. So omega tau is roughly 100, between 10 and 100, depending on the material. In silver, this is the largest one, by the way. Silver is absolutely special material because it has the lowest relaxation of plasmons. And plasmons are the key thing for nanophotonics. The next after silver would be gold. People still often prefer gold because gold is more chemically stable. But in terms of all effects related to nanophotonics, like field enhancement, like this nanoantenna effect, which you can make with these plasmonic structures, silver is absolutely the best material. Silver is silicon in nanophotonics. So same as silicon is nanoelectronic, silver is its counterpart for nanophotonics. All right, so let's play a little bit with this formula and rewrite it in a different form. Okay, this is expression for sigma, which we obtained by using simple formula for motion of free electrons under influence of electrical field, periodically invariant electrical field. So I just doing this simple algebra and isolate the real part and imaginary part, and also use the fact that omega tau is actually much larger than 1. Because you see, I replaced this 1 plus omega tau squared by simply omega tau squared. I dropped this 1 in comparison with this 2. I could keep it. It doesn't matter much. But this effective dielectric permittivity, which has these two contributions, can be written in turn in this form. And now if you introduce a very important characteristic called plasma frequency, which is simply the DC conductivity divided by epsilon naught tau, or in explicit form, it's n e squared divided by epsilon naught m, and it's equal 10 roughly. Well, to be specific, for gold and for silver, it's 9.1. It's actually the same, nearly the same for gold and silver, 9.1. That's the plasma frequency. So then this expression for the effective dielectric permittivity acquires this form. This is related to famous Drude formula. Drude formula considers perfect conductor with absolutely free electrons, where there are no contribution from the bond conductivity. In this case, in the Drude formula, epsilon B is replaced by 1. That would be pure Drude formula. The Drude formula, let's say, in its original form, implies there is no any contribution from the bound electrons. Then it's simply 1, as in vacuum. Okay, in vacuum, it's simply 1. However, it's so simply to modify the Drude formula and take into account this contribution from the bound electrons, which typically related to the interband transitions when we're speaking of solids. For example, for silver, this epsilon B indivisible would be 5, roughly. It, in principle, it does depend on frequency. But since the first interband transition in silver is pretty high, it's 4 eV, it's deep UV. So then when you consider the visible, you're well below the first band which you can be excited. Therefore, within the visible, when you range very little the frequency, epsilon B remains nearly constant in roughly 5. For gold, for example, it's roughly 9. But for gold, this epsilon B does depend on frequency because the first interband transition is close to 2. I don't remember, but it's actually indivisible, like 2.5 or something like that. So therefore, silver is a better material in terms of that it can be considered as material with free electrons, with more, let's say, it's to a larger degree material with free electrons than gold, because in gold, the role of the interband transition is by far more important than the role of interband transition in the case of silver.
So where does the interband transitions affect this equation?
Say it again.
Where do the interband transitions affect this equation?
Right. Epsilon B is related to interband transitions. Epsilon B is related to bound electrons, and that's when you speak of solids, it can be related to the interband transitions. And therefore, I'm saying, like, what specifically this number would... For a metal with perfectly free electrons, that would be 1. But in materials, that's not 1, it's something. First of all, it does depend on frequency. However, for different materials within quite relatively large spectral range, it could be roughly constant. And I'm saying, for example, for the visible in silver, epsilon B is 5, nearly constant.
But I would have thought that interband transitions would lead to dissipation, thus relate to the imaginary part in silver.
Interband transition could contribute to dissipation as well. In other words, it could modify tau, that's true, but that would require it to excite quite a number of electrons. The most immediate contribution of interband transition is related to this epsilon B because it's related to bound electrons. When you consider bound electrons, you should consider what is the resonant frequency for that bound electrons. And the resonant frequency for that bound electrons is exactly related to the interband transitions.
So this epsilon B, is it real or this is...
It's real.
It's real?
It's real. Okay, at least for the materials we are interested in here. Well, in general, it is not real. In general, it's basically a sum of these Lorentz oscillators. That would be the most general formula for epsilon B. It's just sum of all possible these Lorentzians. Okay? However, for metals which we are considering now, for silver and gold, it turns out it's roughly real and roughly constant. In most general case, I should write it down in the form as just summation over these different harmonic oscillators related to bound electrons. Because bound electrons are described by harmonic oscillators. There could be many of these different harmonic oscillators. Therefore, the exact formula would be just sum over the harmonic oscillators. However, if the frequency of your light much less than the frequency of first transition, which is interband transition, then all this summation could be replaced by simply omega naught squared in the denominator, because omega is much less than omega naught squared, and it would become just constant. And that constant, I'm saying, turns out for silver, for example, to be 5. Okay, what I'm saying, let me illustrate this. It's all good questions you're asking. This epsilon b describes the contribution of bound electrons, which we describe by the Lorentz model. So it can be written as something roughly like this. Okay, where, let's say, summation goes for this p, for different frequency for these harmonic oscillators. However, if this omega is much less than all omega p's, which is the, in the case of these materials, would be a different interband transition, then it, all this would be roughly, could be replaced as this. And this is much smaller than omega p is much larger than gamma. And that becomes just constant and real. Okay? So for metals, specifically for silver, it's roughly 5 for the visible range. But in most general form, it's just summation over these Lorentzian terms, harmonic oscillators.
I have one more question.
Yes, sure.
For bound electrons, is it interband or is it more like interlevel transitions?
Well, in most general case, it's intralevel. But if you have a situation when, but in this particular case, these excitations of free electrons are already taken care of with these terms. And when we consider in the contribution of bound electrons, that would be related to, but in this particular case of silver, it would be related to interband transition.
What's going on,
yes?
When in a semiconductor, if a bound electron is excited, it becomes a free electron. Is that not the case here?
Semiconductors, when, let's say, heavily doped semiconductors, they can also have situations when electrons are nearly free, and then you can describe them with the Drude formula. So, but the plasma frequency wouldn't be that large because the density of these electrons wouldn't be that high. But it's actually a very good point. Heavily doped semiconductors, their contribution could be described by the same Drude formula, so but with different plasma frequency, because the concentration wouldn't be that large.
I guess my question is, in this case, when a bound electron changes band, is it still bound?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, but you see, when I, no, the question, the thing here that the frequency is well below the interband transition, okay. So it means that you don't excite it to the next band. But it's still there is contribution to dielectric permittivity. That's the thing to appreciate. The frequency of light is less than the frequency of interband transition. Therefore, there is no this process that you move electron from the lower band to the upper band. But despite that fact that you don't excite them to that next band, there is contribution to the dielectric permittivity because they are virtual transitions. You're not physically move electrons from the lower band to the upper band because the energy of photon is not sufficient. If you would move, then the effects which he mentioned would occur, like you would modify tau, relaxation rate, that's all. What I'm saying that the frequency of light, that's the case I'm considering, it's smaller than the energy gap. And there are some bound electrons which do contribute to the dielectric permittivity. Okay? So the thing to appreciate here, if the energy of your photon is less than the energy gap, then the electrons which cannot be actually excited to the next band do contribute to the dielectric permittivity. And I'm speaking of that contribution. Okay, like if you take gas, there is electrons. Let's say if you radiate it with light, the energy of photon could be much less to excite electron to the next state. But still, I mean, there is epsilon is not equal vacuum. There are lots of examples like this. All these insulators I was talking about, just consider insulators with light, with photon energy much less than the energy of interband transition. But the electric permittivity of these dielectrics is different from one. And it all comes from these bound electrons. If the consider harmonic oscillator, single harmonic oscillator, if the frequency of your light less than the frequency of excitation of your harmonic oscillator, it still contributes to the dielectric permittivity according to the Lorentz model. So that's the point here to appreciate. So although there is no physical excitation. So other questions? Good, thank you for asking. That makes it more fun. All right, so if you now plot this real and imaginary part, okay, that's my real part. This is my imaginary part. The real part, you see it has this dependence, 1 over omega squared. That's what is shown here, the real part. The thing is to appreciate when omega is less than omega p, it's negative. And the fact that the epsilon in metals is negative is absolutely critical for understanding their properties. Because epsilon is negative, light is expelled from metals. It doesn't propagate through metals. Because recall that refractive index is defined as square root of epsilon. If epsilon is negative, you get square root of a negative number, which means it's purely imaginary. And therefore, the wave which is wave propagation, which is described by this term, and recall that k is n omega over c. So if epsilon is negative, n becomes imaginary number. When you multiply I by I, you get minus. Therefore, light exponentially decays in metal. It's evanescent. It's because epsilon is negative. Again, the logic here, if epsilon is negative, n becomes purely imaginary. And if it's purely imaginary, this ikz becomes minus something z, meaning that exponentially decays, evanescent. So that's a very important for understanding properties of metals, that epsilon, real part of epsilon, which is related to the refractive index, is negative. The imaginary part goes like 1 over omega cube. And so that is shown here. And if you now, for aluminum, by the way, for aluminum, it's nearly like the Drude metal because epsilon b is nearly equal 1 for aluminum. So then the formula acquires this formula. And now if you recall the result which we obtained for harmonic oscillator model, and you look at the high frequency limit, then the imaginary part behaves like this compared with this, and the real part behaves like this compared to this. So you see the Lorentz model in the limit of frequency much larger than omega naught predicts similar, if not say the same behavior as we have for metals. Why? That's a question for you. Why, if you take the harmonic oscillator model, the Lorentz model, and consider the limit of large frequencies, we get something similar to what we have in metals?
Is that the phase lag approaches 180?
No, 180, well, yes, that's true. That's that's what actually, yes, that's what the Lorentz model would predict if you go to the case of high frequency. But that's not the whole story. That's, you're speaking in terms of the phase lag. That's, it's related to what you said, but it's not what I expect. There is a simpler answer to my question. Okay, let's think of the Lorentz model. Lorentz model is just a harmonic oscillator. How you would move from harmonic oscillator to free electrons? So what is the difference between harmonic oscillator and free particles? The restoring force, which is given by term proportional to omega naught. The restoring force results in terms of omega naught. If the restoring force goes to zero, what happens with omega naught? Restoring force, remember, it's related to kx, and omega is square root of k over m. So if restoring force goes to zero, in other words, k, the coupling constant goes to zero, like in Hooke's law, then omega naught goes to zero. So the limit of free electrons corresponds in the Lorentz model to the limit when the restoring force goes to zero, what is the same, omega naught goes to zero. But you could think in a different terms. If omega is much larger than omega naught, it's same as omega naught goes to zero. So therefore, it's quite natural that if you take in the Lorentz model and tend omega naught to zero, or let's say omega is much larger than omega naught, then you should get similar behavior as in the case of the free electrons. In other words, say frequency is much larger than the restoring force. You basically, the restoring force doesn't play much role. You're so much away from the resonant. It's same like omega naught goes to zero. Not say, but I mean, it's you could get qualitatively the same. Okay? So therefore, the high frequency range, you have kind of similar behavior what you have in the case of free electrons. And another thing I do want you to appreciate, that if you take the Lorentz model and simply set omega naught zero, you should reproduce the same results which you have for the case of free electrons. So that's, there is this transition between the two models. Oh, okay, it's almost... Okay, in silva, I mentioned this interband transition occurs nearly 4 eV. Okay, that's interband transition. Therefore, when you look at the reflectance, it actually drops down here dramatically because of the interband transition. At low frequency, reflectance is very high. Light is expelled. It doesn't penetrate because of this exponential decay I was talking about. Okay, and here what I plot is this real part of epsilon associated with free electrons. It's purely through the formula of the real part 1 minus omega p squared over omega squared. It's negative. It goes like this. And this is the effective, which takes into account the contribution from the bound electrons. Okay, from the bound electrons, this interband transition. Therefore, the effective has like this, the form like this, which is a sum of the free electrons and this interband, the bound electrons. So that's the effective dielectric permittivity. So that's what we discuss actually in quite detail. So this is just the summary. Well, that's what we're going to consider next time. Let me not go through this because anyway, we're going to consider it next time. And for now, I'd like you to appreciate two most important facts, that what we are speaking of bound electrons, usually implying like insulators or semiconductors. The Lorentz model is pretty good. When we're speaking of the metals, then we treat free electrons, which could be considered as just a limiting case of the Lorentz model, again, when you set just the restoring force equals zero, omega naught equal to zero. The think about semiconductors, most important thing, it's interaction of electron with its hole, which could be roughly treated as hydrogen atom, but with much lower energy because of very large epsilon and larger size of this exciton. In electrons are nearly free particles, and therefore the Drude formula works very nicely. And we introduce the effective dielectric permittivity, which takes into account the contribution of both bound electrons, because in metals, not all electrons free, you realize. There are also inner electrons in sitting in the inner orbits. Those, of course, are bound, and they provide this contribution to epsilon b. Only valence electrons are free to move, or conduction electrons are free to move. So those electrons provide this Drude-like contribution. And this both contributions are very important. In metals, of course, the role of this term is particularly large. When omega, let's say, omega p, remember, is like 10 eV, which is near UV. When you go to the visible, like 2 eV, 10 divided by 2, it's 5, being squared is 25. So this term is actually very large and negative. That's my point. Okay, even in the visible, this is epsilon is large and negative. Like we just, for example, we just made estimate for the visible light, it's minus 25 epsilon. So the characteristic, most important characteristic feature of metals, epsilon is very large in magnitude and negative. All right, so let's stop at this point. We meet at Thursday. Thank you.